39, please?
That's me.
Okay, would you come up, please?
Yeah.
Where did you want me?
Right there, I'm sorry. 139. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Donald Dunn, Vidal's.
I didn't get your last name.
Dunn, D-U-N-N.
Thank you.
The Senate Bill 139 is primarily, well, simply for the purpose of eliminating verification on pleadings. As you know, the pleadings, which are primarily the complaint and the answer and the reply, now must not only be signed or subscribed, but also an oath, in the form of an oath, that it is true as the pleader verily believes. And it is our proposal to eliminate this need from pleadings in Oregon, and it would bring it in line with federal practice. It would require, although that isn't the goal, I don't mean to make it sound that way, it's just that it has precedent. It would eliminate the verification and simply require either the attorney or the client to subscribe, and the subscription would constitute a certification that the person signing it has read the pleading, that is to the best of his knowledge, that to the best of his knowledge, information, and belief, there's good ground to support it, and it is not interposed for delay. Now, essentially, the only argument that I've heard proposed against it is that it might impede the opportunity to impeach the party who filed the pleading at a later time, either in the same case or in a different case, by pointing out that he had made admissions that were damaging to him in the situation and cross-examination. I would point out that at this time, the party merely pleads, and especially it's sympathized with by a jury, that, well, this was legal language, and I simply signed it, and it was my attorney's doing. I think that it is limited in its value, and I would further propose that if the subscription were the attorney's, the pleading could still be used for impeachment purposes, because the attorney is, after all, the agent for the party and uses information supplied by him, and the attorney makes the allegations within the scope of his authority. The main problem with verifications are that it sometimes is troublesome to get your client in to sign. It might mean a little time off from work to get down to sign in front of you as a notary public. And particularly troublesome is where you are in a different town and the case is filed in another county, say, so that, and your client lives in that county where it is filed, and with the present rules, he alone can verify. So you have to prepare the complaint, mail it to him, he goes seek out a notary public somehow, and it might be tough after five if he's a worker, then mail it back to you, and then you mail it down to the clerk. Now, I submit that this certainly is a waste of his time, and it does not help the progress of litigation. I think another important factor to consider is that in Oregon, we do have the dual practice, the federal court, which has eliminated verification, and the state courts, and I have yet to hear anything by hearsay or otherwise where an attorney in the federal court, who is used to the state practice as well, said, well, darn, I sure wish we had that verification in federal court. It's just a non-entity, I believe. I think that constitutes essentially the arguments for the bill, and I have set them forth in more detail in the paper I've placed at each of your places. And if any members of the committee have questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Oh. You don't remember the vote at the bar convention?
I don't.
It was unanimous. No opposition. It was the, unfortunately, the early Saturday morning.
How many people?
I think I would have if you had.
No one there. No vote.
I'm curious to know why you did introduce this years ago.
They did.
We introduced it in the last legislature, and why it didn't pass, I'm not sure.
Tabled in the House.
I might be able to turn my testimony to shed some light on that.
Questions of Mr. Gunn? Senator Agerson?
No.
Questions? Thank you, Mr. Dunn. Senator Carson?
Senator Brown, members of the committee, I'm Wally Carson. I'm a state senator, but I'm appearing here on my own behalf, and not as a representative of the bar or the people of Marion County or
any special interest.
Or any special interest or whatever. The question, if I may, I'm here in opposition to Senate Bill 139. Mr. Dunn has given a very good statement of the arguments in favor of Senate Bill 139, and the answer to Senator Hoyt's question, this is the best I can tell, word for word, to repeat of House Bill 1350, which appeared before the, after passing the House last session, appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee 2 years ago, and was tabled unanimously at that time. It is back. It has been introduced before, and perhaps more times than that. That's neither for or against the bill, but it has been in before and did pass one House, did pass the House of Representatives. My concern, basically, I think there appear to be two arguments. Let me speak to the first one, of verification versus certification. I'm not particularly hung up on whether we continue the notary public aspect or whether we shift to the verification as we've done on a variety of other things, such as inheritance tax reports and some others. So if the committee feels that the verification of a notary is troublesome, Don Wilson, Representative Don Wilson, even had a bill in 67 to do away with notary publics, and in my view had substantial merit. Might save some of our brethren from being disbarred, as a matter of fact. I think that, I'm not really hung up on whether you substitute certification for verification, but what I am concerned about, and I think the major thrust of the bill, stated or unstated, and Mr. Dunn carefully pointed it out to the committee, is the fact that this now would permit, under any circumstances, the party to avoid signing his complaint, now, or other pleadings, answer, or whatever the case may be. I deem this to be very critical, a critical need, and I think it's a need that the Oregon State Bar should hold on to. I very seldom heard the federal rules cited, particularly in this area, as being any particular benefit until we get into pretrial and some of the screening procedures, and I know some counties have the quasi-pretrial, but maybe we'll get to that. I think it's important at some time early in the proceeding to have the plaintiff come forth and sign that the facts that he's basing his claim on are true, as he believes them to be.
Are you appearing in opposition?
I am. I thought I was making that clear, Senator. I'm sorry. So I think that we now permit we now permit the in certain circumstances the attorney, if he knows the facts, and this would continue to sign the absence of the plaintiff or in the absence of the party. But I think we should continue at all times to have the party sign the pleadings, because really we are attorneys, and I think, or lawyers, and our responsibility, I think, is to inform the client of what the practice is. It's true that it's used in many cases for impeachment. It's true that it's used in many cases for aggravation, when dealing with aggravations, to go back to the original complaint. It's used frequently whenever you want to find out what the plaintiff said, and if it's just the lawyer signing it, the argument that Mr. Dunn gave, and that is the one that's frequently used now on impeachment, is, well, I never read the complaint. That ought to embarrass the lawyer a lot more than it embarrasses anybody else in the courtroom if he signed a complaint without having the lawyer take him over it. The arguments in favor of this bill are to conform to the federal practice, and to me, that's almost an anti-argument. Conforming to the federal practice as I know it, which is not extensive, there's little to recommend that. Another second major reason is that it's troublesome. And Mr. Dunn has accurately pointed out that when your client lives in a different county, you may have to resort to the post office, or you will take time. But I suggest when you're suing somebody in any particular area, you ought to be willing to take the time to have the client read the doggone complaint and understand it before it's filed. And I must confess that I have not heard any complaints, as Mr. Dunn did point out, to the federal system on a lack of verification. And I've heard no complaints except through this committee and the reinstitution of House Bill 1350, complaints from my brethren in Salem at least, that the requirement to have the plaintiff read the complaint and sign it that he believes it's true is troublesome in Salem. Now, I don't dare speak for Central and Eastern Oregon, but that's my concern.
Questions of Senator
Please answer Carson. Questions. If you like,
Senator Mr. Smith?
Senator, would you have objection if this bill were to be amended to provide that you live more than 50 miles from the county seat or the home of your attorney that would not have to sign the affidavit?
Senator Smith, Madam Chairman, I think that would probably, I used to indulge, as the Senator knows, when I was in a different body, if met in the same general area, indulge in the distinction between Eastern, Central, and Western. Then I spent quite a bit of time over in Eastern and Central and found out that that's really not a terrible hang-up over there. I think to circumscribe mileage differences would only confuse the problem, and I really don't think that the mileage works that great a burden. If you would remove the notary public requirement and move to a verification of the pains and penalties of perjury, it amounts to a 16-cent transfer. Unless it's a big complaint, it might be a 32-cent transfer, where you mail it to your client, he signs it and mails it back to you. I'm well aware there is some time involved. In fact, I heard the other day that if we'd given the conduct of the war to the post office, it would have been better. They may not have ended it, but they could have slowed it down a lot.
One other question, then. You probably wouldn't vote for an amendment which would divide the state in two, which we can do legally, and apply this to the western part of the state of Oregon and move the eastern part out.
No, Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't support that, although I would recommend Senator John Burns does have a unique proposal that goes partway in that direction, a county bill.
Senator John Burns.
You mean you'd vote for that?
No, I didn't say that, Senator.
You're treading on pretty dangerous ground. Senator, there's another important distinction that hasn't been pointed out between the current federal practice and the state practice, and that is that the federal practice has notice pleading in effect, and that the issues are really framed at the pretrial conference, and it's a whereas in the Oregon civil procedure, you got to put your allegations in your complaint. So I would concur with you for that reason, that using the federal rule doesn't make it analogous to the objective here. I do quite a bit of federal practice, and I see a great difference. One other thing that I feel is it's an effective practical tool in argument. If you can point out to the jury that notwithstanding what the party may or may not have said in response to the fact that he didn't read it, point out that he had subscribed to it. And, so I guess, just to get my feelings clearly on the record, I would agree with you.
Senator Keith Burns.
Well, matter of practice, in Rockland County area, most attorneys do a lot of litigation, sign the things anyway. There's an understanding, the attorneys on the other side, they aren't even going to raise an objection to it. Unless, and if they're going to, they call and tell the attorney. Almost by practice, it eliminates to a very great extent in Rockland County.
Further questions?
Yes.
Senator Hoyt.
It seems to me that the very relationship between a lawyer and a client, now, I'm assuming that all relations are good because I know they're all ethical. Under that kind of situation, certainly no client would sign something without the advice of an attorney. Now, if this is almost, you might say, a procedure, a form, a ritual, you know, so to speak, to get the process underway, the fact that the lawyer signed it for the client would seem to be, if we're going to assume that everybody's responsible, would be certainly expeditious and would be just as good as if the guy memorized the damn thing before he signed it.
Well, I think there are several assumptions, Senator Hoyt, in that, and that is that, you know, that there is this close cooperation and this matter. I will not deny for the moment that the practice that Senator Keith Burns indicates or does not exist, nor would I deny that many clients don't read their complaints before they sign them. I think that is true, but I think that's terribly unfortunate because I think the I would like to see the practice of law move in the direction of having the client informed on what he is going, taking the other fellow to court about, what he's saying about the other fellow when he drags him in, rather than leave that up to being sorted out at some later time, like at the trial. I don't think it's that troublesome, and I think it's very usually what happens in the testimony at the a year ago, according to the minutes on House Bill 1350, the individual who presented the matter at that time, a man by the name of Mr. Stam Johnson, pointed out that the practice usually is to have the interview and with the client prepare the pleadings and file them, and to have the client come back and read the pleadings, the complaint or the answer or whatever, is time-consuming. I think if a lawyer purports to be speaking in behalf of a client, it's important the client understand what the lawyer is saying, particularly in these several stages.
Just one thing. Don't you have a gratuitous assumption that the guy really understands when he reads or is going to read? I think the argument works both ways. It probably won't anyhow.
Well, that very well may be, and that's, I think we've spent a lot of time in the legislature, I know you have, Senator, in trying to put it in English so that the layman can understand. I think that's one of the responsibilities of the lawyer. I grant you, when you're talking about res ipsa loquitur and some of the other problems, it's difficult for the layman to understand, but I don't think that's any reason for wiping it out.
Was that Latin word we had? Copy on
info.
No. Non-compos mentis.
Senate Iberalis, I think, was it.
No, it was something else.
Well, yeah, but that's all I've seen.
No,
not the way you said it. The way I said it was.
That word was delicatessen. I remember it now.
Well, thank you.
Molly, are you proposing to do away with the verification and
Madam Chairman, that kind of is a new twist, and I just heard it before. The argument had been the troublesome aspect, as it was time-consuming to do it. I had not heard the argument about substituting that, but I'm not a supporter of the notary public system for a variety of reasons, and I would have no objection. I would just assume it went night-night, and I would
the
urge you
thing.
The whole thing. But if this committee deems that that would be an advance in the law to perhaps get around the problem of Eastern Oregon where they have to go find a notary public, allow it for verification, then I'd have no objection to that. I'd like to see all our law move in that direction, so that I'd have no objection.
Senator Ivers.
I was going to say, to solve the Eastern Oregon problem, we could make every bartender a notary, and we wouldn't have any problem getting it notarized.
Most of them are now.
Make every senator.
Oh, no.
Madam Chairman. Very kind of you.
Further questions, Senator Carson?
I appreciate the opportunity to be heard. Thank you.
Anyone else wish to comment on Senate Bill 139? Yes, sir.
William Dethridge, attorney, practicing at Medford, Oregon, chairman of the Oregon State Practice and Procedure Committee of the Oregon State Bar. I heard Senator Carson's comments concerning the use of the verification to impeach a witness. I am a defense lawyer, and I have used it on occasion. But you still can impeach the same client because he is bound by his lawyer's pleadings. Now, I know that Multnomah County has a practice of ignoring the verification. They do not follow the law at all. In Southern Oregon, we do. In fact, in Josephine County, Oregon, if I mailed an unverified answer to the clerk, she returns it to me and will not file it. In fact, they're assuming, I think, more rights than they have. What this causes is an increased cost to the client. If I am defending a client who resides in Grants Pass, Josephine County, I have to mail by the sufficient United States Mail Service a copy of the answer, the original answer, to my client in Grants Pass, and he in turn returns it to me by mail, and I in turn return it to Grants Pass to be filed. There's three individual mailings. Well, we only have usually 10 days in which to make an appearance on behalf of a defendant, and usually our client has been late in getting us the complaint. So what do? We file dilatory motions. We file dilatory demurs in order to prevent a default being entered because we do not have sufficient time in which to file an answer.
Madam Chair.
Senator Keith Burns.
You mean to say that the defense bar will quit filing dilatory
yes,
motions and demurs if we pass this?
Yes.
Bill?
In fact, we're doing better in Jackson County, I think, in regard to our dilatory motions. We probably were the worst in the state at one time.
Senator John Burns.
Well, Mr. Dethridge, are you telling me that, and I do defense work, are you telling me that when they call you up and say we're going to give you the defense of this case and the plaintiff's attorney is so-and-so, that you can't either call up the plaintiff's attorney and say, can I have a reasonable extension, and can't get it?
You can, but I have had the practice, and there's been a recent Supreme Court case where an insurance adjuster did the very same thing, and a default was taken. And our Supreme Court held that only the court has the power to grant an extension of time in which to appear. So I think a stipulation between counsel, if you suddenly had one break down, would be in somewhat questionable.
I've never seen it break down in 10 years in Portland.
I think Portland has a different system. I think you've learned, I think, in a large city that you have to cooperate. But back in, I guess, in the woods in Eastern Oregon and Southern Oregon, we have some cutthroat practices at times. And there are some people that wouldn't give you the time of day if you asked for it, because you just the last week before kicked their teeth out.
I've never seen that. With attorneys and all the Pendleton and every, I've never had a case with anybody in Medford. Maybe I'll stay away from there. But, I'm appalled to hear that. Now I really am.
Well, there's many motions filed that I can see. We've tried to avoid it in our oral arguments. Now we do everything on written memorandum. But I would like to remark in regard to Senator Carson as to, do you want something verified under oath? Well, we know in our modern practice, if you have an important case which involves the veracity of the party as to what occurred or what happened, we use depositions. And that's the best. A deposition is how to impeach a party, not a plea.
Further question to Mr. Dethridge. Senator Keith Burns.
Bill, what do you think of the having it here, though, it's not necessary to accept having your attorney sign it unless upon the receipt of the pleading the other party requires.
That would be fine.
Then everybody would be happy.
See, I think what happens is that I know when my, as Senator Hoyt says, the client relies upon the attorney. I think the whole theory of this old law of verification goes back to the idea to prevent a lawyer starting a lawsuit without his client's permission. In other words, I imagine back in the old days, some lawyers filed cases without their client's consent.
what guarantee would there be against that happening in the cutthroat bar which you practice?
Well, I think we have disbarment proceedings now. They're quite, although I think they're more on suspension now, but I think our bar as a whole has improved. Now, again, what I'd like to point out, our committee, and I've been on this committee for approximately 6 years, this is not a what we call a lawyer's bill. We keep hearing all of our bills being lawyer's bills, and they're bad bills. Actually, this is a client's bill more than anything else, because it cuts down time of the client that has to come over and do this. It also cuts down legal costs. It may not be very great, but I think it will be a step in the right direction. As Senator Burns said, Keith Burns, that if the other side would desire a verification of that pleading, a request like we have now, demand for verified accounts, should solve that problem.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Deffridge. Anybody else on 139? Turn to Senate Bill 134.
I just got warmed up a bit.
Senate Bills 134, 137, and 141 were a package, weren't they?
They are. They complement each other. They do have relationships.
Right. Senate Bill 141 is in Consumer Affairs with a subsequent referral to Judiciary, but here are copies of 141 so you can get the picture. Mr. Deffridge?
We think in the Procedures and Practice Committee of the Oregon State Bar that one of the real changes that should occur in our procedural statutes and is the statute of limitations. There have been a number of cases in the last few years which indicates that our statute of limitations is really outdated so far as the modern cause of action is concerned. In fact, there's been cases where people have lost their valuable rights between the distinction, say, for example, trespass and nuisance. And I have presented to the committee, Mr. Kellington and I have a 9-page memorandum which gives a kind of a history of some of the problems that have been facing the Oregon litigants concerning the statute of limitations. Now, every year the legislature meets, we see some change being made in the statute of limitations, but usually it's done at the request of some special interest group. For example, the doctors, ORS 12.110 subsection 4, I think, has been amended in the last three legislatures, which involve the time in which to discover medical malpractice. Now, I've set some earlier Oregon cases concerning the distinction between nuisance and trespass. And under our law, a nuisance is only you can only bring an action within 2 years or you're barred from bringing an action. Under trespass, you're entitled to a period of 6 years. And the famous case that gave rise to this distinction is the Reynolds metal case. And I think you're probably familiar with, there's been a series of cases throughout Oregon in federal court and in our state court where a chemical invisible to the eye would fall upon the neighbor's property and allegedly cause damage. And in the Martin case, which is an Oregon Supreme Court
case.
I believe one. There was a long, extended argument whether or not this was a nuisance. And I think our court, a trespass, our court rightfully said, yes, it is a trespass. Otherwise, the plaintiff in that case would have been barred from bringing the action because he had failed to commence it within 2 years. Now, I think when we first started to study how to revise the statute of limitations, Mr. Kellington, who is with me here today from Medford, we were the two principal ones concerned, thought, well, we'll just try to do some doctoring up of the statute. And we started our handiwork, and we found out that we were greater failures than the present statute. No matter how hard we worked, there were always these unanswered problems as to the type of cause of action. So at the end result, we recommended to our Oregon State Bar Committee in 1971 and adopted the present Senate Bill 134, which actually abolishes most of the particular statute limitations for all causes of action except those involving recovery of real property and actions upon judgments or decrees, are the old sealed instruments that existed prior to 1965. We now provide in this bill a common and uniform statute limitation for all causes of action of 3 years. The commercial code would be a special statute that would be covered otherwise. There was a recent case concerning that an action under a secure transaction would be 4 or 6 years, and our Supreme Court, I think, in the last 2 months held it to be 6 years. But there are special provisions in our statute which provide other limitations than set forth in Chapter 12. Now, we've also provided a discovery period on the statute limitation. That is, if you cannot discover the damage or injury that has occurred to you within 2 years from the date of the act or omission, then you would have 1 year from that date in which to, after discovery, in which to commence the action. Subject, however, there would be a maximum cutoff of 7 years. In other words, if I were to do a wrong to you and you did not discover your injury until after 7 years, then you're out of luck, and I will discuss that briefly later concerning a recent case in that regard. Now, there would be no problem at all to solve the nuisance trespass distinction. All you could say is, let's just have a statute of limitations that involves damage to real property, make it a flat type of statute. But I came across in my practice a real bad problem. And usually, as lawyers, we find it in legal malpractice actions. On this occasion, I was defending a lawyer for legal malpractice. Unfortunately, he had, prior to the famous case of Bales for Food for Pool, had taken a case upon which he thought to be a breach of contract. The facts were that this engineer had been hired to design a golf course and lay out the golf course. And his client felt that the engineer had not kept his contract. In fact, had breached his contract by doing substandard work. And lo and behold, while he's investigating and working upon this case, comes down this famous decision in Oregon, which held in effect that an engineer, or it could be an architect, or an attorney, are a doctor, and we knew in the doctor situation, in Dowell versus Mossberg, that even though there's a contractual relationship between patient and the doctor, that unless there's an express, and there's even a question about that, unless there's an express agreement to do a specific act, that if the doctor commits a breach of his duties as a good doctor and failing to follow good standard medical practice, he is only subject to a 2-year statute of limitations because the court says this is negligence, not breach of contract. Now, on the other hand, if the doctor sues the patient for failing to keep his bargain, that is, to pay his medical bill, that's breach of contract. Now, in the Bales for Food case, what happened there, and I think there probably is a member here of the committee probably familiar with it, at least there was the Burns, I know, was involved in the decision. I don't know if it's Senator John or Senator Keith or the now Judge Burns. But in that case, the man had been hired to lay out the location of a building, and it was to provide parking space. And unfortunately, he put the building in the wrong place that, in effect, cut down the prime parking space. And the plaintiff's attorney, I think, maybe got carried away in describing all the breaches of the contract by the engineer. And he referred to not keeping in good workmanship. Lo and behold, our Supreme Court said, that's not a breach of contract. That's negligence. Now, what happened in that case? That landowner was barred, thrown out of court because of a 2-year statute of limitations. Our Supreme Court in that case did call upon legislative amendment of our statute of limitations. And this is the reason I think our committee thought it was a very serious problem, that the only way you can do this is to have a uniform statute where the classification of the wrong doesn't have to match a particular statute. We all know that if you don't bring your action within 3 years, or if there's not discoverable within a total of 7 years, then you're barred. Now, Section 2 of our Act goes one step further, and it does take away the governmental immunity of the statute of limitations. And I, in the committee, thought about this for a while. I had a case, I represented the city of Ashland several years ago at the request of the city attorney. The case, I think, was 12 or 13 years of age. It involved a breach of contract against Field Pipe for failing to provide the right type of pipeline for the water system of Ashland. It not only put the plaintiff, the city, in a difficult point because of the passage of time, but mind you, what the defendant is faced with. Here, a governmental body may sleep on its rights forever and not be barred by the statute of limitations. And I think this goes back to the old theory is that, as I point out in my memorandum, the king can do no wrong. Well, we know in Oregon that we've changed that philosophy. We now have the Oregon Tort Claims Act. Now, we do provide exceptions to that statute. One is in regard to taxes and any special statutory provision provided elsewhere where the statute would not run. And after I had drafted, and Mr. Kelling and I drafted this bill, and been approved at the 1971 meeting of the Oregon State Bar, we came to, crossed my mind, I was researching a legal problem, whether or not an unopened, dedicated street constitutes a public street. And in my research, I found, much to my amazement, that many, many years ago in the 1800s in Oregon, you could acquire adverse possession against the state, or at least the city, on streets. So the state of Oregon decided to pass a special statute, which is found in Chapter 221, I've cited in the brief, which provides you cannot acquire adverse possession on an unopened, dedicated street against the city. Now, Mr. Bashaw, who's the city attorney of Medford, called my attention to this as well. It may be that this Section 2 of our proposal might have another provision, an exception, that would it would not affect the recovery of real property owned by a public body. Now, unfortunately, as a member of the Oregon State Bar Committee, I cannot recommend such a proposal because our restrictions provide that we must follow the bill that has been submitted and not make amendments of the bill. But we believe that on the common type of cause of action, such as I deal with the city of Salem on a contractual matter, which now is 6 years for breach of contract, why should the city have 25 years to wait to sue me when I only have 6 years to sue the city of Salem? And this is the inequity that occurs because we know as lawyers, every case that is old usually is very difficult to try. We've seen murder cases come back after 25 years where the person has been denied his civil rights, at least the court said he has been. He's returned to Klamath Falls. There's no trial because there's no witnesses, no evidence.
But you don't propose to change that.
I'm not proposing to change. This is in the civil measure. So basically, we think that this would be a tremendous step forward in Oregon. I've done research, Mr. Kelling has done research to find out what the other states have done. And much to my amazement, our sister state of California is far worse off than we are. I looked at their statute of limitations. They even have distinctions between oral and written contracts. And I have cited a table of cases concerning actions for personal injury, wrongful death, and property damage. And you can see from this table, there's no magic formula for when to bring an action. Some have 6 years for everything. Some have one. I believe Louisiana, you'd better be really fast, 1 year for personal injury, property damage, and wrongful death. Some of the states have a common 3 years. Actually, our proposal is very similar to the state of Washington to the north, which has a three-year statute of limitations. So we feel that not only would it be a step forward in good procedural practice, but think of all the costs that could be saved to the public, who would not be faced with costly litigation as to whether or not he has the right statute of limitations for his cause of action.
I have a question to Mr. Deathridge. Senator John Burns.
All right. Mr. Deathridge, I agree with you concerning subsection 2. I couldn't agree more with you concerning the point that you make on page 3 on the difference between the BI and the PD disparity, tort and damage. But I read subsection 1, and it was kind of interesting that you mentioned your legal malpractice problem, because I plaintiffed a legal malpractice case where an attorney made it was terrible and handled the sale of a large ranch and didn't report it on the income tax returns, and 3 years after the sale had been consummated, the client didn't know, very uneducated ranchers. The IRS came back and assessed a $25,000 fine penalty against them. There was negotiation with the tax people for more than a year where it couldn't be resolved, and the people had to then make the payment. And at that point, we were thrown into I came into the picture as an attorney 4 years after the tort, if you will. I called it a breach of contract. It was in about 68. The Bales case was used by the defense attorney. We argued, well, demur and everything else on the basis that the statute had expired, and so we got into the question of discovery, and the case was ultimately settled. But in that situation, where you use the language here, she'll be commenced within 1 year from the date the injury or damage is first discovered. So we first discover it when the IRS comes in 3 years after the act and assesses us a penalty, and then we negotiate with them for another 18 months before we file. And the argument is made, well, you discovered it, I mean, if this were to pass, you discovered it 18 months ago and you didn't file within the 1 year tolling period. Would you not agree that my client here would be out of luck because he didn't file within a year after it was first discovered?
Yes, if it was discovered more than 2 years after the act or omission.
Okay, well, don't you agree that there's some that we shouldn't try to encourage litigation by forcing a person to file quickly where they're still trying to work it out with the other party there? This, if we limit it to 1 year, it would seem to me promote some litigation.
Well, it may in a very small area where you're not able to discover, but generally speaking, we've enlarged the statute for more support where you have 3 years.
I understand that.
I can see a situation. I've had the very same thing occur where companies have agreed not to assert the statute of limitations. To continue negotiation beyond the period. If negotiations break down, that can occur. But I would say in your situation that you would have to file within the 1 year. Otherwise, you'd be barred. And our committee felt as a whole that if you allowed the period of time to extend beyond the period of discovery, that
usually the case is not that great of a case. Now, I can see there's some justification in your argument, but I've found also from practice that when a person's been defrauded or something is kept secret from him, say a doctor hasn't told the poor patient that the sponge is inside your incision, when that patient finds out about that, or discovers the wrong, I never seen much negotiation. The first thing I see is a complaint that's coming down the path because there's anger, there's the punitive, the vindictive nature. I think also where you've been defrauded. And I think in a situation of this nature that it would probably require on good legal practice not to negotiate but to file in order to prevent the running of the statute.
Well, I never introduced a special bill because it affected me, and I thought that I had a conflict of interest and I wasn't going to lose a case in court and then come down here and sponsor a bill to change it in the future. But I see it arising with some frequency in connection with legal malpractice cases, which are more prevalent today than they were a few years ago.
Now, in your situation, there might be a good still argument under the Joseph versus Bear and the Burns and Bear case, which came out in December of 1961 in 260 Oregon, on one of the bills that we're trying, or one of the sections we're trying to repeal here. The court indicates that when the damage occurs is when, of course, you have no cause of action until there's damage, and there should be a good question in your case whether when was the actual damage to your client as to accrual cause of action. In that case, you would, under the present law, you would have 10 years, and based upon negligence under our proposed bill, you would have 7 years.
Yeah, I'm aware of that.
Further questions, Mr. Desert. Senator Keith Burns.
You know, I don't have a big problem with any of this except one place, and that is that where you, I think 7 years is too short a time when you have been applied for in a case where there was inability to discover it. That's an exercise of reasonable care should discover. I think in the Beale pipe case, that I think a lot of small municipalities and that, they didn't know what was causing this tar and oil and stuff that's getting into the water system. They never dreamed that it was coming off the inside of this pipe, I recall. And some of them didn't discover it, all that was off. Stuff had rusted through. This stuff was buried under the ground several feet. And so I think there it's reasonable to say within 1 year after it's discovered. I mean, assuming they couldn't reasonably have discovered it.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of them caught it. There's an awful lot of money in those little water districts that have taken up all that pipe and replaced a lot of their equipment and everything. Same thing you have with automobiles. Some of these automobiles have built-in defects in them. 56 automobiles now you find that they're killing people. And there's no way in the world a person would know that anything wrong with that. I mean, this bothers me here. First has no chance of discovering it. The hidden thing is full of parts inside. Nobody can see it. Even a mechanic. I mean, they don't tear the automobiles apart and check them before they sell them. And that's the part that bothers me. The rest of it, I don't care. Anybody discovers it. I mean, I understand the situation like John. I sympathize with that. It may be that you could put a qualifier in here that, in the course of maybe negotiating with a third party or something, mitigate damages or doing something of that nature. But what's your reaction to that?
Well, I'll tell you how we arrived at 3 and 7. 7 was the original magic number for medical malpractice discovery until 1971, when it was reduced to 5 years by this 71 legislature. We used that as the 7-year period of discovery. The 3-year was just a, we just selected something in a little more than 2, but less than 6. In other words, this is how we arrived at it. We thought this is a fair basis on a conflicting interest, because we could see those who have interests that would want to have a short statute of limitations,
yeah,
would want a real short period, and those that would want a long time. So we tried to reach just a balance. And I must say our committee are not that good to say we've corrected the right balance, which is just a suggestion. But we think the most important thing would be to have uniformity of the statute.
Well, I think that's very important, though. But there's that one part. There's one other question I may have.
John, I have a law review article right at the
statute of limitations with respect to mutual accounts or notes, another bill? Did we hear another bill?
House Bill 138, or Senate Bill 138.
Where I had some questions about the effect of tolling the statute if there were interest payments.
No, that's oral instructions to a jury.
I'm sorry, it's the other bill. It's
mutual accounts.
Yeah, mutual.
It's mutual accounts, and it passed the Senate already.
Yeah. Okay, well, now this doesn't have a repealer in there, does it, for any of for that section?
It would not affect that section. We drafted that bill as well. That section only talks about when a cause of action accrues. It does not state how much time thereafter you would have.
Well, I'm concerned about where you have a account that's been running since 1961 or so, and the person that owes the money is paying his interest every month and not making any payment on the principal, and I wouldn't want him to be outlawed by the statute of limitations.
You would not be, as I understand, a charge of
yes.
interest would
constitute a payment.
Senator Hoyt.
Does this bill apply to the type of problems that contractors and engineers and architects have?
Yes.
Is this the bill that the architects and engineers are interested in?
There's somebody from the Institute of Architects who wishes to testify in favor of the bill. I don't know if you, Mr. Dendrich, want to go ahead.
I thought I might discuss the other two bills.
I just want to identify. I knew there was a bill in it, and this is the bill that the engineers and architects are interested in.
They're signed
very well
up.
Yeah.
Then my other question is, what happens in terms of neighbors about fences being on the wrong spot and adverse possession? Does this apply? This bill
no.
apply to that?
We accepted that out. That's 12.050, which is still a 10-year statute of limitations, adverse possession, recovery of real property. It's not affected by this statute. We thought that Oregon, we're still rural area in many parts, that we still believe in 10 years for real property and recovery.
Where does it say you've accepted it out?
It's the only statute that has not been repealed, one of the few statutes. We repealed 12.080, 12.100, 12.110, 12.115, 12.120, and 12.130. But in the statute, you will see...
9.6 is where they would exclude it.
Yes. ORS 12.050, Senator Hoyt. Would be the one on page 93.
What was the number again, please?
12.050.
Yes.
That is not repealed. That would remain the law of this state.
I see. Thank you.
The same would be true for, say, if you have paid a judgment, you would still have 10 years to recover it on 12.070.
For the questions of Mr. Dethridge.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Keith Burns.
Can I ask a question on the record of this bill, but related to something that was in.
All right.
We were talking about cities, how they would be not be exempt except in these special situations here. There's a bill that will be before the voter introduced in the committee bill, and the...
this one?
Not 141, no. Where it's... maybe it's over the house. You know,
does away with the $50,000 limit?
No, well, it does. Yeah. There's one in on that, too. It's another
how long?
On giving notice on the tort claim. Do you really think that's required anymore? A governmental unit is any special category of what they require of this notice, 6 months' notice?
Our statute, of course, our proposal here would not affect the Chapter 30 in regard to giving notice. I think that probably the shortness of time is still unfair, probably to the injured party. 6 months is not very long. And I think maybe actually it should apply equally to everyone. We have a reasonable statute of limitations on personal injuries. I think in the old days, it's no different than a corporation. You take General Motors. They're massive in general, and they have cars everywhere. One of their Corvairs runs off the road.
couldn't they have the same benefit as the city of Salem to receive notice that someone's claiming about a defect?
I think the same reasoning applies there. I don't think that the notice requirement in our Chapter 30 should remain, but we, of our Procedures and Practices Committee, did not take any stand on any substantive, what we call substantive issue of law, and we believe that we cannot, as the Procedures and Practices Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Deffridge. Mr. Basshair?
Shaw.
That's a good way to announce it.
I'm not sure, no.
My name is Roy Bashaw. I'm from the Cutthroat Medford, Oregon Bar, and I'd like to have you know that it's a pleasure to be up among gentle, fair-minded people like you. It's sort of a pleasant relief. I would like to address you very briefly, and I'll be very brief, on the subject of Senate Bill 230. I'm sorry, Senator, did I interrupt?
Well, when we moved the county seat over to Crineville, it would be enlightening to you, Mr. Boyers.
We noted Crineville there. We weren't sure what state it was, but it's over east of Medford somewhere, I guess. I'll be very brief, as I was going to say. I practice law down there, and maybe during the last 23 years, I've represented several small cities. Bannon, Port Orford, that's not around Medford. That's in another one of your counties.
Right.
Bannon, Port Orford, Seaside, Talent, Phoenix, Central Point, Medford, and Jacksonville. Now, I represent Medford and Jacksonville. And with regard to Senate Bill 134, my comment on the first section is that, in principle, I just couldn't speak too highly of the efforts of the committee and of the importance of making uniform these various statutes of limitation, which are such a hodgepodge right now. It has been mentioned that there shouldn't be any reason to distinguish between public bodies and private individuals in regard to civil claims based on contract and property rights. I'd like to suggest to you that as a result of observing the way these small towns, which I have represented with great pleasure, operate and must operate, I submit there is some reason to make a distinction. Now, I'm not talking about the county or state levels of government, which I will assume operate on a higher level of diligence. But the fact of the matter is that people who are in charge of public rights held for the benefit of the taxpayers do not have the time, the opportunity, or the inclination, or for various reasons do not in fact look after those things quite as carefully as a person looks after his own business affairs. Now, I don't speak disparagingly of any kind of government when I say this. It's just a fact of life. The reasons are political, or they are questions of business, questions of fear, anger, and many good causes of action or claims which should have been asserted or should be asserted are delayed for some period of time because perhaps the local government is going through a crisis. And to impose, for example, a nominal, a three-year statute on cities, small towns, as well as on other people, I think might put the people who really have the right to have those causes asserted, those claims asserted, at a disadvantage. I don't want to take up your time with another saga, but basically, for example, You might consider the case of a small town I happen to represent. Built a reservoir in 1968, used quite a bit of its money to do it. The reservoir started falling apart in 1969 because the engineer designed it wrong, and the contractor probably did the job wrong. It's not important. The reservoir continued to fall apart. During 1969 and 70 and 71, the council of that city was engaged in many distracting difficulties involving recall elections, turmoil, mass resignations, trouble with the DEQ, and just all kinds of stuff. And finally, around 1972 in the fall, things settled down enough so they could look at their reservoir and figure out what to do about it. And the 2 years involved in the 1971 Act had expired. They take solace in the fact that the insurance companies will probably pass on the savings to their other customers by way of reduced premiums. This little town, of course, the people... I think the point I'm trying to make is this. In principle, the idea of removing the exemption from the statute is a good one, but give us a better break than 3 years, give us the people. 3 years doesn't make it. 4 years for a turnover, so that you get a clean sweep and somebody who might want to assert the people's claim against somebody seems a minimal one.
Are you directing your remarks only to Section 2?
Section 2. Section. That's right. Section 2.
Questions? Senator John Burns?
You'd have a... You'd be out of luck in federal court in an antitrust case, wouldn't you?
Federal court, they looked to the substantive law of the state. They looked at the procedural law of the state, determining the statute of limitations, and then found out that you had a cause of action for antitrust against one of my clients. If you didn't bring it within 3 years, you'd be out, wouldn't you?
Yes, Senator, I think there's something about discoverable in here that might help us a little bit on an antitrust situation. I'm not very up on that. I agree with Mr. Dethridge when he says that 25 years is too long. I think some limit should be put on it. I think it's unreasonable to keep alive a cause of action which, as a practical matter, is dead because of the staleness of the evidence. But I think, considering the difference between the types of entities, look on it as you have another statute in here in Chapter 12 that deals with people who aren't quite competent and they're protected during a period of time. Look on my various clients as like that. They need a new guardian from time to time. And until that comes along, you give 10 years to the property owner, maybe give us 10 years, us, we the people.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Bischoff. Madam Chairman, I need some clarification. Maybe you can help me. From what you're saying, I'm trying to figure out, does Section 2 have any limitations at all?
Section 2.
The one you've been talking about.
Do you have the bill?
Yes, I have it here. Section 2 wipes out the immunity except as to assessments and taxes, and where statutory limitations have been made elsewhere. And elsewhere, as Bill Dethridge pointed out to you, elsewhere there is a statute that protects cities as to unopened streets. The statute doesn't protect the county or the states. I think they probably should be protected, too, if they need it.
Dick, does that answer?
Yeah. I think it does. In other words, Section 1 would apply to everybody excepting the municipalities under these special situations on taxes and these unopened streets.
Municipalities, yes. Taxes and unopened streets, cities are protected.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Payne?
Senator Brown, member of the committee. I'm James L. Payne, Payne, Sedecase & Smith, Architects, Salem. I have a brief prepared statement here.
take a moment, pass copies to you.
I'm James L. Payne, AIA of Payne, Settecase, Smith, Architects, Salem, Oregon. And I'm representing the Oregon Council of the American Institute of Architects. We in the profession are convinced that a reduction of the period of professional liability from 10 to 7 years would be advantageous both to the general public and to the architects. Any structural deficiencies which may exist will normally become apparent within a 1 year period and a complete weather cycle, and certainly within 5 years. The strength of building materials such as concrete actually increases over the years, and steel retains its strength indefinitely provided its surface is adequately protected. Because of the extended period of liability, architects are experiencing greater difficulty every year in obtaining adequate insurance. If this trend continues, some offices may be faced with the alternative of closing their doors or of practicing without proper insurance. The general public would suffer from either of these alternatives. The older, established offices are especially vulnerable. Because of their increased exposure over the years, they would be the first to close their doors if adequate insurance becomes unavailable. We in the profession are of the opinion that a 5-year period of liability would be advantageous to both the public and the architects, but this reduction from 10 to 7 years is certainly a step in the right direction.
Questions of Mr. Payne.
I have a
question. Senator White.
Mr. Payne, in the fourth paragraph of your presentation, you say because of the extended period of liability. Now, refresh my memory. Has the state of Oregon been extending this periodically to making you more vulnerable?
When I used the word extended, I was thinking of the 10-year period it's presently on.
What was it before it was 10?
I don't recall that that's been changed recently.
Well, then, as a matter of fact, it hasn't been extended, has it?
No.
I want to be sure I know what you're saying here. So I'm interested in the effects of the public's advantage of this. They're going to be protected because more people are going to be able to practice that might otherwise not be able to buy insurance?
If the trend in insurance continues, it's easily possible that a number of the established offices will face the choice of either closing their doors or attempting to operate without proper insurance. I'm sorry that we were not able to get a representative of the Continental Casualty Company here today to speak to you people. We made that effort. He is presently in California. We'll be back shortly, and we hope that you will have an opportunity to discuss that in detail with you.
Now, Chairman, I'm trying to ask the right question, if you'll bear with me just a minute.
Sure.
I just don't quite see why it's getting worse. Are the architects getting worse? Are the lawyers getting smarter? Or the insurance company getting tighter? I don't see what's getting
worse.
Well,
that's a good question, but the information that we get from Continental Casualty, every year we have to fill out a detailed report, of course, in order to get covered by insurance. And when these people come and speak to us at our national conventions and our state conventions, they just state that it's getting tougher all the time. There are just one or two major companies, to my knowledge, in the United States writing this type of insurance, and they're just wondering if they're going to continue.
But what's new? They wrote it 20 years ago.
I think it's the, I won't say the large, I won't say excessive, but at least large amounts of damages that they say they're not making any money on the
amount that we're paying them. It looks like a lot to us. We pay thousands of dollars a year for this insurance, but they say they aren't making any money at it, and they're wondering if they're going to continue to write it.
Madam Chairman, will somebody help me? I want to know why it's any worse now than it was 20 years ago. If we have extended the years of liability here, there's got to be a reason. Either the juries are getting more than inflation would justify in terms of at least 25 years difference, or what?
Well,
you're asking the question.
Am I asking it correctly?
Yes.
I'm not qualified to answer that. I don't have the statistics on it, but to my own personal feeling is yes, that the much larger, that is, the jury amounts are much larger than they were 10 years ago or 25 years ago.
Senator Keith Burke.
Well, I'm not getting any place, because if it's any more than inflation would take care of the insurance fee too, you see, if that's the only factor.
The inflation has no relationship to the amount of the insurance policies that we as architects, that is the cost per year of what it runs. It's going way up. And I'm not prepared to answer that side of it. I'm sorry that we don't have our insurance.
I'm embarrassed that I can't say it better, but you're not helping me.
Senator Keith Burns.
Yes, sir. How do they base your premiums on your malpractice insurance?
It's quite a detailed form that we must fill out in order to get.
I'm talking about on what basis they set the premium per architect, per engineer.
All right, that's what I'm trying to get at. Part of it depends on whether we do our own structural engineering. Part of it depends on whether we have our own mechanical consultants in the office. It depends on the overall volume, the dollars per year of gross income to the offices, and the number of professionals, the number of registered architects, the number of associate architects, the number of designers, draftsmen, clear down the line.
Further questions?
Yeah,
Senator John Burns.
How many carriers cover architectural malpractice now?
The main one that I know of is Continental. I do think that Lloyd writes some, but most of the architects carry with Continental.
Are you not over there?
Any other questions? Senator Keith Burns.
If you build a building that's got a life of 40 years, the thing falls down in 20 years because of defects caused by the architectural firm, why shouldn't it be liable?
Well, of course, we maintain that the buildings that are built to last 40 years, if there is a difficulty, it's going to show up in considerably less than the 20 years that you're speaking of.
So if you put in there they sue within 3 years after it's discoverable, you'd have no objection to that.
Well, I don't want to think about that one.
Thank you, Mr. Payne. Mr. Killington?
That was 5 minutes
anymore. Senator Brown, members of the committee, I'm here on behalf of the State Bar also, and I don't have a great deal to add in addition to what Bill Dethridge said. I echo what he said and ably said about the bar's position. I did bring with me some Law Review articles that we discovered in our research of the situation that present the history of the growth of statutes of limitations in different states, and I didn't make enough copies for everybody in the committee. My Xerox got a little tired, but what copies I do have are here. There's two from the Harvard Law Review and one from Western Law Review, and they indicate this growth from the old writ system to the system that we presently have and other states have, and the problems that occur from the growth of statutes of limitations put in by different people grinding their own axes and so forth, rather than having an overall concept of the situation. One thing that I didn't hear mentioned that some of your other legislators may ask you when this bill is discussed is the retroactive effect that a statute of limitations bill of this nature would have, and I think the Law Reviews and other research that we've done pretty well determines that it could lengthen a time within which to bring an action that has accrued. and it would be retroactive in that effect, but it wouldn't be retroactive to make the time period shorter. In other words, if you had a contract action and it had accrued, it wouldn't bring it from the 6 that you presently have down to 3. It could extend the tort that was 2 that had accrued up to 3.
Questions of Mr. Kellington.
You mean because of the constitutional thing, we couldn't do that studying in the bills?
No, I mean just as far as the effect of this. It could extend some accrued cause of action that have accrued prior to the enactment of the bill, but it wouldn't shorten them, so it would take somebody's rights away in that regard.
What about the one-year discoverable part? Would that extend a contract cause of action?
I don't.
Follow me.
I don't follow exactly.
All right, in sub 1.
Yeah, where you have the 1 year discovery or
reason. You should have the bill there in front of you. Isn't it on the table? 134.
All right, within. Except when it isn't discoverable.
Line 8.
And you have one extra year in which the after is discovered. Would that apply to a breach of contract which you might not discover until 6.5 years?
I think it would if the cause of action had accrued before this. Yes. If in relying on that 1 year it would lengthen the time that you have now, yes it would.
Okay.
Questions? Thank you, Mr. Kellington. We'll turn to Senate Bill 137.
This is a companion bill to Senate Bill 134, and actually Senate Bill 141, as Senator Brown indicated, was in the Consumer Affairs Committee at this time.
I misspoke myself. That is not your bill. It's a different bill introduced by the Committee on Judiciary, but it's not yours. Maybe you want to mention what your bill is.
Oh, this is our bill, Senate Bill 141. Yes. We drafted that in 1972.
Thank you.
10-year period that Mr. Payne just discussed, I believe, because it would be in conflict with the our uniform statute of limitations.
Well, your bill's all over me, but I put one in last two.
All right. Senate Bill 137 is a companion to 134 in that it only makes 2 changes. One, it provides that where a defendant is hiding within the state or is outside the state, that you only have a maximum 7 years in which to bring the action. And two, it codifies the existing case law of the state that if you can make service upon the defendant through a statutory agent in the state of Oregon, such as the Department of Motor Vehicles under the non-resident motor statute found in ORS 15.190, the statute does run. Unfortunately, the reading of the statute as it now presents itself would lead you to a contrary opinion, but 2 Supreme Court decisions caught 2 plaintiffs unaware. They said you can serve the defendant by serving the department, and therefore the statute runs. We've decided to make it very clear in this amendment that it does run if you can find anyone to serve the defendant, whether an agent or the defendant himself. But it would not apply to the long-arm statute. We want to be clear about that. Such, I refer to the long-arm statute, which is ORS 14.035. That is, if someone has been doing business or commits a tort within the state, but cannot be served within the state, but can be served outside the state, the statute of limitations would not run until you, in this state, at all, which I think is basic fairness. And that's, in sum and substance, that bill. I would like to comment in regard to Senate Bill 141. After we had drafted these measures in 1971, lo and behold, your legislature was busy, and you adopted what is known as ORS 12.135, which sets a 10-year maximum period for discovery concerning defects resulting from construction of homes, as against architects, engineers, contractors. We think that this bill, ORS 12.135 is contrary to the uniform statute of limitations that we've proposed, but there's another good reason. That bill is added nothing to the existing law, because the Supreme Court, in the case of Joseph versus Burns and Bear, in December of 1961, approximately 6 months after the adjournment of this legislature, said that's been the law all along. And then they cited ORS 12.115, which was adopted in 1967, which provides a 6-year or 10-year maximum limitation from an act or omission. So actually, on the books right today, is I think Justice Holman wrote the opinion. He was saying that there must have been some special interest group up here trying to get special legislation that got 12.135 in effect, but that ORS 12.115 controls the situation, so it's duplicitous and actually adds nothing to the present law. But we believe that it should be repealed because there should be no difference in discovery of an attorney's malpractice, an architect's malpractice, or any other tort or any other wrong. It should apply equally to all people.
Questions? Senator Keithburn.
In 134, let's see, you repeal ORS 12.135?
Well, 12.135 did not exist when we approved the measure that's known as Senate Bill 134. See, that was adopted in 1971 before the legislature had passed ORS 12.135.
So didn't you review it before you put it in this time?
Then we, in 72, we then reviewed ORS 12.135, and then we presented to the Oregon State Bar this Senate Bill 141 to repeal ORS 12.135.
Well, that cost $600.
Did it? Well, I'm sorry.
You mean there's a separate bill in to repeal 12.135?
Yes, and that's Senate Bill 141.
Okay, now, what about 12.115?
Now, 12.115 is also repealed because we've amended.
This is the only time it's repealed.
Thank you, Mr. Dedd.
I understand.
Mr. James Payne. He's ready. All right. And Mr. Collington, did you wish to speak on
he's abandoned us.
All right. There is another person who wishes to be heard on 134, so we'll never have another short hearing on 134 at another time. Is there anyone here to be heard on Senate Bill 161? Evelyn, you're not interested in any other bill?
No, I'm not.
Or 160. You notify the bar office that 160 and 161 were on the hearing and no one showed up.
Yes, we're heard.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. You're not signed up.
I'm from the Clackamas County Bar and we're quite quiet up there from Redmond.
How are you on land use?
Well, I'll have to learn how to spell land use.
You represent the
I was on the other side of that little fiasco out in Clackamas County, I'm happy to say. Madam Chairman, was it 160 that you wanted to go ahead on? This.
And your name, please?
I'm James Redmond from Clackamas County. I'm one of the former chairmen of the Oregon State Bar Committee on Real Property. As you know, spouses can presently create a tenancy by the entirety by a special form of deed, which is authorized by Oregon statute. This bill, Senate Bill 160, would allow other people to do the same thing. And to us, it avoids the useless act of going through a straw man or a dummy in order to do what this bill would allow to be done. Many times you'll have a situation where people want to do what this bill proposes, and you run across the street and find a bachelor lawyer and you deed everything out to him, and then
simultaneously he gives you a deed back and you run down to the courthouse and make sure you record them in the right order. This would avoid this. Now, Paul Gerhardt, also another former chairman of the Real Property Committee, is less in love with this bill than I am, and I think you'll probably want to hear his feelings on it. But basically, we're trying to eliminate one step that some people feel you have to go through when you're creating this situation.
Questions of Mr. Redden? Thank you, sir. Okay. And did you wish to testify on 160?
Not necessarily, no. I don't think I don't want to say anything about 160, just 161, really. Okay.
Did you wish to testify on 161?
Yes, Madam Chairman. Presently, in the state of Oregon, we usually, if we're going to use a form deed, we go down to Stevens Ness, and if it's to be a warranty deed, we get form number 633 or 723, typically on a bargain and sale deed, or 721 on a quitclaim deed. These deeds, I'm sure, must have had some sort of origin in Elizabethan England. For example, what does it mean when it says, with the tenements, hereditaments, and appurtenances thereunto belonging or appertaining? And I don't think most lawyers know what this means. I'm not sure that I do. Many times, whether we like it or not, non-lawyers are preparing these deeds. Many times it's the real estate office. Many times it's the person themselves without the assistance of anyone. To me, if the Catholic Church can switch from Latin to English, and many other churches can shorten down their services, the least we can do is make it easier for the public to convey real property as far as the language is concerned. And hence the reason for Senate Bill 160.
Questions of Mr. Redden? What? Senator Smith?
161.
Excuse me.
Sorry. It occurs to me that, you know, I don't know how long we've been getting along with these kinds of deeds. And I grant you, I agree with your premise. If you you want to reduce the language to somewhat understandable English. But I wonder if there's really more than, if there is any specific example of involvements or mistakes. And the thing that occurs to me is that this kind of a bill is going to warrant changes in all deeds and forms in the state, and whether that cost is going to be justified for the simplicity which you bring forth as the reason for the bill. There isn't any other good purpose than just redoing the language.
Stephen,
maybe we're on the wrong track.
Senator Smith, this question was raised in the committee, and our committee worked very closely with Stanton Allison, who I would say is one of the probably best scholars in this field. And you will find towards the end of this bill a specification that this will not eliminate other forms of deeds, but will simply be additional forms that will be authorized. So what we're saying, Senator, is here is a way that people can convey property with some confidence. They'll have a statutory authorization for this simplified form. Those people that wish to continue using the present forms will be allowed to do so. What we would foresee is a gradual transition, Senator, and I don't think there'll be a cost problem.
It makes sense.
This is why it's in.
Other questions, Mr. Redmond?
Your attorneys are rather practical at times.
Well, I appreciate that comment. You might just consider all the times you've been involved in deeds, and you know, if we all ask ourselves how necessary this language, we.
Senator John Burns.
Do we have special warranty deeds now?
Special warranty deeds are in existence now. You can buy those forms at Stevens Ness. And, of course, the special warranty deed is also provided for in the act.
Well, I just wonder, Jim, as a matter of statutory drafting, if it's a good idea to. I know we have, with respect to summons, I think we have the form of the summons in the statute. I wonder if it's particularly good drafting to have the form of the deeds in the statute. Apparently the committee thought so. I had some question in my mind.
Senator Burns, this question did come up, and I believe the consensus was that if we're going to encourage a simplified form, we should try to set forth some sort of example. I suppose it's akin to the samples you see in certain types of pleadings and notices and things of this sort.
Senator Keithberg.
John, in response to that, I think it's desirable, although we don't have to put a lot of things in the statute, so I don't think it's desirable to put everything like the first thing you should put in the statute, but at least you're limiting the terms that the court's going to be interpreting. And I think in the long run, it's going to cut down the litigation.
Well, I wondered, you know, like when we did the criminal code, we had Don Collette prepared an appendix of forms. We didn't enact that in the law statutorily, but I think they're uniformly used, and I think from time to time, of course, if we had rulemaking power by the Supreme Court, it would be simple. They could prescribe the forms and keep it out of each session of the legislature by having to amend the statute in order to revise the form. That was the question.
One additional thing I might mention. When you deal with real property, I think you're generally fairly skittish. There's a substantial amount of money involved. So it's difficult to encourage lawyers and lay people to use language that we're proposing. If they have this backing, I think it'll be extremely helpful.
Senator Keithberg.
It appears to me that these are all sufficiently short. None of them are going to run over the back of the page, so you're going to reduce the recording cost limit to $1.50 on every deed. Right?
The counties will raise the fee then to $2.
Senator Burns, that's an excellent point. Another way of saying that is we can increase the white space, leave more room for the description.
Other questions? Senator White.
You might have said it, I missed it. I got the idea that there was, in existing statutes, forms that were obsolete or...
No, sir, there are no statutory deeds.
I see. I misunderstood.
I promise you won't increase the minimum bar fees.
This will take business away from lawyers, I'm confident, because many lawyers draw deeds because people don't know what tenements and hereditaments and things appertaining are, you see. So actually, it's a bill that will take a little business away from lawyers, but it's a public interest bill, and I think warrants consideration.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Redman.
Thank you. Yeah. I might add, I did prepare something very brief on each bill. All right. Thank you.
And I didn't get your name.
Paul Gerhardt. I'm a former member and former chairman of the Oregon State Bar Committee on Real Property. I've been anxiously awaiting the introduction and hopeful passage of this particular statutory deed form bill. We did, in 1959, the bar suggested through the preparation of by Stan Allison and the auspices of the Continuing Legal Education Committee, put out a real property handbook which included statutory deed forms, but which Stevens Ness never decided to print up. Some lawyers apparently felt in their own minds that the habendum clause, which says to have and to hold the following described property, had some substance, although none of us who studied the matter found that there was any present substance in that language. The same might be said of tenements, hereditaments, and appurtenances. I might also mention that the treatise on real property, Powell, pointed up in his work that was printed over 10 years ago that the District of Columbia and 25 other states have statutory deed forms, that there are the statutory quitclaim deed forms in 20 states, so we feel that this is desirable to get with it. I would also observe that the quitclaim, we have set out here definitely the substance of the different kinds of deeds so that any lawyer or layman, if it chooses, but preferably the lawyers would
have a clear understanding without doing some extensive research to what is the difference in the significance of these deeds, the warranty deed, the special warranty deed, the bargain and sale deed, and the quitclaim deed. We've also made it very clear that one substantive change in this bill from the existing law is that a person who takes under a quitclaim deed can still be a good faith purchaser. Now, under present Oregon law, one who receives a quitclaim deed necessarily takes with notice that there may be some lien or encumbrance on their property. The change that is made by this bill would make it clear that the title companies can give good insurance, marketable title, in a grantee under a quitclaim deed. Today they won't. They will require that one uses the bargain and sale form or warranty.
Can or should. Can or have to.
Today the title companies will not, because of the law as enunciated by the Supreme Court to the effect that one receiving under a quitclaim deed takes with notice that there may be, and if it turns out to be that there were encumbrances against the title. They may not be recorded, there may be no actual notice whatsoever, but the mere fact that the grantee took under a quitclaim deed gives him notice of the otherwise unnoticeable.
Well, isn't there some merit in retaining that, because it all goes to the matter of consideration?
Oh, no, the consideration is a second issue. One has to be both a good faith purchaser and pay value. Now, what we're saying in this bill is that the mere fact that he takes a quitclaim deed doesn't deprive him, if he pays value, of the right to be a good faith purchaser. But, of course, under the recording statute, which is a separate enactment entirely, to qualify and get the protection of the recording statute, one must pay value, record his deed first, and have no notice. Under the present law, he may pay value, he may have no actual notice, there may be no earlier recorded deeds against him, but because he took as a quitclaim deed, he has notice. And we're trying to change that fact, that point of law. Now, that is the one substantive change by this bill. And it is desirable because there's another preventive aspect relative to quitclaim deeds also. The law, as you see in examining this bill, under a quitclaim deed or... No, excuse me, not under a quitclaim, but under a warranty deed, special warranty deed, and bargain and sale deed, these operate to pass after acquired title. A quitclaim deed does not operate to pass after acquired title. That's the law of Oregon today. However, there has been some indication from one of the Supreme Court justices that if an appropriate case should ever come before him, he would certainly attempt to convince the court that maybe the quitclaim deed should pass after acquired title. Well, it is the feeling of those of us in support of this bill that it would be desirable to specifically nail it down that a quitclaim deed passes only what the grantor has at the moment he gives the deed and nothing that he may get tomorrow.
That's what it does.
And that's what this bill does.
Well, isn't that stealing?
Pardon me?
Is that stealing?
Oh, no. There's no stealing at all.
Well, if you sell me a piece of land and you find out that you have a windfall on that land after you've conveyed it to me, well, why don't I get it?
If you ask for a bargain sale deed, that's exactly what you should get. And that's exactly what you will get by this bill, if you have a bargain sale deed. A quitclaim deed, normally, notice the language here, that he releases and quitclaims. A release. The idea behind the quitclaim deed, historically and today, is that you are releasing whatever you have today. You're not giving him the land, you're not purporting to convey the land, but merely to release whatever claim you now have against that piece of ground. No, this is not stealing in the remotest. If he uses the word convey, then he's passing what he has today and what he gets tomorrow. If he uses the words release, all he's doing is releasing what he may have today.
Is this present law?
Yes.
Other questions, Mr. Gerhardt? Thank you, Mr. Gerhart. Senator Kingsborough.
I withdraw the question. A little bit more from this side.
Any other business to come before the committee? Meeting is adjourned.
Played this practice for more than 10 years.
State of California.